causes for the experiences we're having now. And we did all of kind of looking at designing our own individual karmic purification plan, right? So what I urge you to do as a result of the karma quiz was, you know, pick a couple of the karmas that seem to be, you know, giving you the most unwanted experiences right now, and then work on being very mindful of those actions, you know, avoiding those actions, so being really mindful. We said one of the results of karma is having that habit to do that again, and that's why I said for a lot of people, when they get the results of the karma quiz, it's not a surprise. They go, oh yeah, I know these are some of the things that I struggle with anyway, right? Because we said one of the results of karma is having that habit energy. So being really mindful of those actions to really avoid them, because they're hard to avoid. We do have a habit of doing them. So that's one kind of solution, is avoiding new non-virtues of that kind of category. And then doing the opposite. We have that fourth column of the karma quiz where we said, do the opposite of that as a way of kind of canceling out that karmic imprint, right? We say that karma is held as imprints in our mind. And then if you do the opposite of that, it's sort of like defusing a bomb, right? It won't go off because you've put some antidote in there, energy in there. So we looked at that, you know, for some of those 10 non-virtues. And then I said both for doing the opposite thing, which you can get creative about. I mentioned a couple of examples, my friend doing the animal rescue, the friend doing the conflict resolution because she found out that she had a lot of divisive speech karmas that were giving her unwanted experiences. And then we can do more traditional practices, all of which we do in conjunction with the practice of the four opponent powers, so generating a sense of regret, relying on the Dharma methods to purify, doing the antidote or the remedy, whether it's one of the traditional ones or whether it's one of the kind of creative ones, that you're actually doing something that's the opposite. And then the power of restraint at the end, or sometimes refraining, it's called. And that is making a realistic kind of pledge not to do that action again for as long as it is realistic. Right? So if it's something like gossiping, don't say, oh, I'll never talk about anybody if they're not present in the conversation for the rest of my life. Come on, be realistic. For some things that are easier to refrain from, you know, taking something that belongs to someone else, killing a human being or an animal, something like that, you could say, yeah, I won't do it for the rest of my life. Some of the habitual hard ones, I think especially the speech ones, right, are kind of hard for us. Make it realistic and then renew the resolve to refrain from that action. And then you kind of build up an imprint of success, which helps encourage you in the practice, right? So I mentioned the example, I think it's like the AA thing, one day at a time. And I had a friend who was in recovery and she would say, one morning at a time, and then an afternoon at a time, and then the evening, and then the next morning, until she was, you know, in recovery long enough, she felt like, okay, I won't drink this week or something, right? But in the beginning, it's harder to make those, that kind of power of resolve or restraint. So it is important to be realistic about that. Bless you. So any questions at all that may have come up in reflection on what we did last week or this purification? Now, there are a lot of traditional purification practices. We don't have time to go into all of them. In the handout, that PDF has the 6 kind of traditional purification practices. And so, you know, it's nice to get instruction on what some of those are. Some of them involve reciting certain mantras. Some of them involve reciting the names of Buddhas, reading certain sutras, and so forth. And so you can get those instructions at another time. And do we know if Ryan is doing that for powers? So he's not going to be doing that. Oh, bummer, because it would have been nice and appropriate. We thought someone was doing a short course on the four opponent powers, but apparently that's not happening.
Stay tuned, it'll happen.
Stay tuned, sooner or later. All right. So any questions about what we, any of that that we talked about last week?
I actually had an incident of thinking about being offered, and it was in Molly's friends, and we were. village making dinner, and this one night when my friend made dinner, and I wanted more. I wasn't satisfied, and there was some more on the stove. And I kind of went and took it, and as I took it, I realized I'm thinking about it being offered.
Yeah.
And that didn't feel good, but at the same time, I had my craving, you know? Nobody died, but in that moment, I was like, I felt it.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, and it's like, it was a simple thing, but she had meant to keep it for herself for the rest of the weekend, and so I had some regret in that moment. So.
And it's such an awesome thing to actually feel your sensitivity for your ethics get subtler and subtler. Like I mentioned this fairy tale of the princess and the pea, you know, of like, they could tell it was the princess because the pea was under the 100th mattress and she was so sensitive. And so you find your ethical sensitivity. And so just that level of discomfort is actually such an awesome sign. And it means that you're getting way more in touch because you might have imagined a time, probably maybe not even so recently, that it wouldn't really have bothered you much. You would have said, oh, we cook for everybody. It's no big deal. I can take, you know, more, whatever. But, like, even getting that sensitivity to subtler and subtler is really cool, you know. And then, and I found for myself, too, like, all messed up. And then I'll feel that regret. And then it really creates an imprint that I do different next time. Like, because that discomfort in even the subtlest thing makes me much more aware of it the next time. And so that's kind of how we learn. And then it just gets subtler and subtler. There's this great story about this Tibetan master called Ben Kungyel. And he's a little bit like the old tale of like Uncle Remus or something. He's like, there's stories about him that are told as these morality tales in like Tibetan culture. And so Ben Kungyel, and so he was staying at a house, you know, kind of like you with a bunch of people who invited him. And in the morning he went to make himself tea. And so he reaches his hand into the teapot and you think, oh, well, it's okay, you're staying at somebody's house, like you can make tea. But it hadn't been explicitly offered. And so he reached his hand into the loose tea to grab a handful of loose tea to put in the pot. And then he caught himself doing it. And so he grabbed his hand with his other friend and starts shouting, there's a thief in the house! There's a thief in the house! And his hosts come running up and they're like, what are you doing? You know? But he like caught himself and then starts shouting, quick, quick, come quick! There's a thief in the house. So you didn't go to that. But it's just one of those stories of like, yeah, you do, and then you sort of catch yourself, and then the next time you do it, you have more mindfulness there. So, yeah, awesome. Any other comments or experiences with kind of being aware of karma, if anybody thought about it in the last week or thought about your karma? Okay. Yeah.
I just love the way that you just put that together, how these kind of for me like an outside ideal or rules or something, or even something I want to live up to, and then like you're just explaining so beautifully how then they become internalized.
Yeah.
So it's more of like just this real time awareness of the actual impact of the harm rather than conceptually an idea that, oh, this is going to produce harm.
I really
enjoy that link.
Yeah, good, because that's kind of the way it progresses in our practice. I mean, sometimes we kind of think, oh, there's a bunch of rules, and then stuff of, you know, am I following the rules or not? But it's not that. It really becomes deeply internalized into this, you know, and it's funny, it's we're going to talk kind of about the results of the path, but we talk about this Buddha nature sometimes. We use the word Buddha nature. And some of the ways that, you know, some conversations I've had with people about it, it's that sort of inner, what is it? It's sort of like this inner guide that is adjusting. And when we kind of go against it, it's sort of like our inner potential for like perfect wisdom and compassion and kindness and everything. And we do something against it, and then we find more and more as the path progresses, we feel it. When we've gone against that tendency of our Buddha nature, then it's like, and that's sort of what negative karma is. It's like we've gone against our own inner nature, and the more our inner nature is strengthened by our practice, you just feel it more and more, even in subtle ways. So that's another way of for me of like making sense of even what it feels like kind of experientially, that thing of like, oh, you know, in just a tiny thing that maybe the person you were talking to didn't even notice, but you notice. No, because it's often I'll apologize to people for saying something and they'll be like, why? And like, I know that it came from a place that wasn't perfectly kind or perfectly whatever, and they didn't even notice. But I knew, you know, that my own intention was kind of going against that inner nature. So it's interesting. It's like there's a metaphor I'm missing for what that is. It's almost like that inner sort of litmus test thing of like going against that inner nature. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the third noble truth, which is the easiest one, the truth of the cessation of suffering, right? So now we're on to the good news, finally, after four sessions, and thank you for your patience, those of you who hung with me this long. And so we say that the logic of the third noble truth is really pretty direct and easy to understand, and it's just because of this. Remember, cast your mind back 3 or 4 weeks, and we said this is how our suffering results are created. So the truth of the cessation of suffering basically just says, because this is a causal relationship, if we remove the causes, we're not going to be experiencing that suffering. So in Buddhism, we say our suffering isn't random. It's not God punishing us. It's a result of karma, which in turn is a result of mental afflictions, which in turn are a result of ignorance. And that's why this whole chain reaction is removable, right? Because it's based on a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. So if we correct our misunderstanding, we're sweet, right? Not as easy as that. It doesn't happen overnight. But this is kind of the logic behind the truth of the cessation of suffering, because all of it is caused by these three elements, all of which start with ignorance about the nature of reality. So they are removable. And all of our suffering is removable. And sometimes, I think I mentioned before, I remember teaching an intro to Buddhism class. And I think it was in Dharamsala, and there was this whole group of Western travelers, mostly young people, about 60 or 70 people from all over the world. There's this young guy, I think he was British, and he read a book by somebody saying that the Buddha didn't really teach cessation of suffering. He taught coping stress-free with our suffering, like coping mindfully, you know, with our suffering. Yeah, exactly. I guess Susan's like, excuse me? And I was like, no, actually, the Buddha taught the truth of the cessation of suffering, meaning no more suffering. Like, I think people can't conceive of that, so they gloss it in this other way. No, he must have been talking about coping better with the inevitable suffering. But this chain reaction of causation was taught by the Buddha, and so because of that, removing these, and especially removing that root ignorance, then means no more suffering results at all. So what does that feel like? Must be amazing, right? So I thought in relation to the third noble truth, we can talk a little bit about the results of the path, because the cessation of suffering means two spiritual goals, and I'll talk about both of those as they're traditionally presented, although differentiating them in the way that is done traditionally, who knows? People are starting to soften that differentiation. But we'll talk about that. And let's see, I'm flipping back and forth here. Let's see. I think, oh, here we go. Very, very next page. So what are the goals of the spiritual path? So we talk about the goal of liberation and the goal of enlightenment. And so liberation or nirvana is a state of the obscuration of defilements are eliminated. And what the defilements refers to here are karma and delusions, right? So karma, basically the first three steps of that other flip chart. So karma, mental afflictions, ignorance, all completely eliminated. So the result is liberation or nirvana. And a person who has attained liberation is known as an arhat. So in green, gold, the state of an arhat. An arhat is a Sanskrit word that translates as foe destroyer. So the foe that has been destroyed is karma and delusion. So such a being is in nirvana, which isn't another place. It's not like heaven. It's not that band from the 80s either, right? It's a state of being free of karma and delusion. So there could be an arhat sitting in this room right now. You don't have to be in a different place. It just means that your mind stream is completely free of karma and delusion, right? So we talk about someone who's attained that state still with, you know, the rebirth that, you know, in that lifetime. So they still have the body of that rebirth, but their mind is free of karma and delusion, so they won't be reborn due to karma and delusion. So at the end of that lifetime, then they'll be liberated from samsara. So that's what liberation means. It means freed or liberated from that endless cycle of rebirth in samsara. Because we said the propelling forces of rebirth is karma and delusion. So no more karma and delusion, no more rebirth. So they're liberated at the end of that lifetime within which they attained that goal of freedom from karma and delusions. Okay? And so there are many stories of these famous arhats in the time of the Buddha. Most of his closest students attained that goal. Some of them, at the end, there's this one story of one of his closest disciples that attained the state of an arhat after just hearing from someone else, not even Lord Buddha, one four-line verse of scripture. It just pisses me off. You know, you hear those stories and you're just like, oh, man, I'm really trying. And still, you know, but they were direct disciples of Lord Buddha, you know, and there was like some amazing karmic connection that was going on. So sometimes some of these old stories are inspiring, and some of them are just really discouraging because you're like, wow. So anyway, lots of stories of these arhats that were direct disciples of Lord Buddha. So that path, sometimes it's called the Hinayana path. Don't ever use that word. It's a bad word. Okay, don't ever use it. Some people say that it means lesser vehicle, but I have a friend who's a monk in the Theravada tradition. Theravada is a better word to use these days for that path. And he said, Hina doesn't even mean lesser or small. It means something like gross or coarse or disgusting. But, yeah, I know. I was like, oh my God, it's even worse than I thought, right? So it's a really bad word. I put it up there because you will see it. Every time I see it in one of the FPMT's translations of some prayer, I write them a letter and say, you've got to get this word out of there because it's a bad word. So anyway, Theravada, which means tradition of the elders. One of the languages that I'm starting to use these days for these two traditions, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama uses these days, is the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition, because that's referring to the main texts of those of the two traditions. For a while, people were using like Northern School and Southern School, which is kind of geographically how these branches of Buddhism spread. But I think Pali tradition and Sanskrit tradition, I like that. And His Holiness is starting to use that. So for those, that tradition, which is more prevalent in South Asia, in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, parts of Vietnam, the main scriptures are mostly in the Pali tradition. And they present liberation as the ultimate goal of the path, except for a few exceptional beings who have the destiny to become fully enlightened Buddhists. So liberation is, you know, kind of posited as the goal of the path. And then the main path is what we call the three prior trainings. And that's the trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So that's the main kind of path for the people in the Theravada lineages of the Pali tradition. And then a second kind of stream is what we call sometimes the Mahayana or greater vehicle or Sanskrit tradition. I'm preferring that language these days. And that's the goal of Buddhahood or full enlightenment. And not only are the obscurations of the defilements eliminated, but also the knowledge obscurations. And these are very, very, very subtle obstacles to seeing the ultimate and conventional nature of reality simultaneously. And I'll explain a little bit more about what that is later on, but they're very, very subtle obstacles that prevent the omniscient mind of a Buddha. So when those are eliminated, one of the qualities of a fully enlightened Buddha is an omniscient or all-knowing mind. So when those are eliminated, that goal of Buddhahood, and then the path is the path of the six perfections. The main path is the path of the six perfections, and we'll talk about what those are in a minute. I know that some of you are familiar with the six perfections. So these are the two kind of main streams of the way that the Buddhist teachings have traditionally been kind of presented. However, nowadays, there's a lot of crossover, right? And a lot of people studying with masters, both of the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition, so the distinctions are starting to blur, you know, quite a lot. I have, there's in Placerville, and some of you, Brandy, went out with me to visit them. There's this group of Theravada nuns that live out in Placerville, and they've all taken bodhisattva vows. They're students of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You know, they've sort of also studied the Sanskrit tradition quite extensively, even though they're Theravada nuns. So there's a lot of a sort of interesting crossover, which is, it's a big advantage, and it can be confusing. It is kind of important, I think, to understand some of the differences in the traditions, because then you won't be confused when the language is used to refer maybe to two different things, for example. So it is kind of good to know, and then seek the teachings with, you know, whoever kind of speaks to you. We don't have to keep these strong distinctions. But these are the two main kind of goals of the path, liberation and enlightenment, as they're traditionally explained. So questions about this? Nilesh?
Yes, yeah. I don't mean to jump ahead.
No, it's all
just,
right.
Just to kind of get some clarity in my mind. So the liberation, or Theravada path there, once liberated, that's ceasing all, you're out of the cycle of samsara. That's,
yeah.
You're done.
Yeah,
gone,
yeah, that's right.
Whereas in Mahayana tradition, their enlightenment, and am I correct in saying that it is the realization of emptiness? Is that the kind of...
That's part of it.
Part of it, okay.
Yeah, that's part of it. And we say the direct realization of emptiness happens even way before enlightenment. So
yes,
it's a necessary realization. But when you've had the direct realization of emptiness, you're not enlightened yet. So you use that realization, keep going back into that meditation, and then it very, very slowly, that realization, repeated, eliminates the defilements and knowledge obscurations, right? But it is a process. We talk, and this is outside of the scope of this class, but we could do it sometime if you want. We talk about the five paths, or the five kind of stages going to enlightenment. One is called the path of habituation, and that happens after the direct realization of emptiness. And you're getting used to that realization, repeating it over and over and over again, and then it gradually completely eliminates all of the defilements, and then you get the permanent cessation of both the defilements and the knowledge obscurations, and then that's enlightenment. So it's dependent on a direct realization of emptiness, but it doesn't happen simultaneously.
Okay.
Yeah, great question. Yeah. Anything else to clarify? Yeah, Susan.
Yeah, it's along the same line. So if ignorance of the nature of reality is at the top of the chain,
yeah,
then in both traditions, either arhatship or full Buddhahood, that has been realize the nature of the true nature of reality, the non-dual,
right,
has been okay. So an arhat then truly does have a non-dual experience, non-dual.
Yeah. So an arhat also has had a direct realization of emptiness even before liberation.
Okay.
So it's a similar process that happens. Okay. And then that arhat uses that realization to eliminate the defilement, but not the knowledge obscuration. And then for the kind of the bodhisattva track towards Buddhahood, then that realization is also used, coupled with bodhicitta. And we'll talk about what bodhicitta is in a second. So it's that combination of the wisdom aspect and the bodhicitta motivation that eliminates the knowledge obscuration that results in
that. Was for my next question. Okay, all right. Thank you.
Any other questions about the distinctions there? Jeremy, how's it going in here? You all right?
I'm just glad to be here.
So, like I said, don't ever use the word Hinayana, these distinctions. They were kind of geographic, actually. And nowadays, like for example, we used to have a center in San Francisco of this Tibetan tradition that was a block and a half away from the San Francisco Zen Center where Suzuki Roshi used to teach, and half a block from like about three different Vipassana centers, and we all kind of hung out with each other's things and did all of that. So there's a lot more crossover than there was traditionally. You'll hear, I have a friend who's an American monk in the Theravada tradition who lives in New Zealand, which is all very interesting anyway. He went to see a Tibetan Lama in New Zealand once. He was doing, in the Thai tradition, they do this thing called tudong, that they just go around with their alms bowl begging. So he does that in New Zealand, which is interesting, because here he is and they don't have any idea what he's doing, and he gets all kinds of interesting things in his begging bowl. So anyway, he's going around New Zealand, and he went to pay respects at this Tibetan monastery because there was a senior Tibetan Lama there, and he, was walking past and went and goes in and did prostration. So the Tibetan Lama looks at his robes and says, Vajrayana, Mahayana, Hinayana. And he still tells the story like 10 years later. He's so hurt. But that is a view that you'll hear, in the traditional view. And sometimes that path is explained for people who are selfish, who have no compassion, and they don't care about others. Absolutely not true at all. So whenever you hear that, just please, try and disabuse people of that view. In those scriptures, Lord Buddha taught both paths. He taught the path that was appropriate for people who were inspired by liberation, and maybe wouldn't have been inspired by the thought to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, right? So Lord Buddha taught both paths that were appropriate for the people that are following those paths, so it's not a choice based on selfishness or anything. And you will hear that sometimes in the Tibetan, and you just go, okay, they never met one of these people, because in Tibet, they just didn't have a chance to really talk. Some of my Theravada friends, we've talked about the different meditation practices, and I've shared with them a little bit what the Tibetan texts say about how they meditate on emptiness, for example. And they'll say, that's not how we meditate at all. So sometimes these things got passed down just because of a lack of cross-fertilization. So it's a wonderful opportunity for us to really talk to each other and gain some understanding of the different paths. But you will be hearing some of this language, so I wanted to introduce you. And then in terms of the goal of Buddhahood, so in the Tibetan tradition, we're kind of signed on for Buddhahood for everyone. So from this point on, we're going to be talking about this goal. And I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the qualities of the Buddha, which is really inspiring. And sometimes you'll hear language that talks about the bodies of a Buddha, the word kaya translated as body, but it doesn't necessarily mean physical body, it just means the parts of a Buddha. And so we talk about the dharmakaya, which is the mind of a Buddha, especially the omniscient mind of a fully enlightened being. So all-knowing. Omniscient means all-knowing, not all-powerful, right? So a Buddha isn't like an omnipotent supreme being that can make things happen. But a Buddha is all-knowing, and especially in terms of sentient beings' karma and delusions and past lives, right? That's the most important kind of quality of that omniscience. So why do you think that's important? Why does a Buddha have omniscience? What's the point of that, do you think?
So the Buddha can know how to help each individual exactly what they need.
Yeah, exactly, right? So since the Buddha is an omnipotent, all-powerful, a Buddha can't change anything for us at all, right? The only thing that they can do is teach us, but they can teach us perfectly, completely in accordance with our mind, our inclinations, our karma, our delusions, our past lives, right? So the Buddha can be the perfect guide, but we have to travel the path on our own. A Buddha is not a savior. You know, I always tell that in the very beginning of classes, like, full disclosure, you're not going to get any saviors in Buddhism, so you're welcome to leave right now. Buddha is not a savior, can't fix anything, can't change any being's karma, it's up to us. But when you have a being who knows your mind perfectly with their omniscience, then they guide you perfectly depending on what your inclinations are. And you hear this, they say that that's one of the qualities of the Buddha, and that so many times I've left a teaching by, for example, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You walk out with your friends and you're like, oh my God, when he said yada yada yada, that was incredible. He was saying that exactly to me. And your friend is like, I didn't hear him say that, but wow, when he said yada yada yada, that was exactly what I needed to hear. Like, there'll be 20,000 people in that arena, and everybody will hear exactly what they wanted, you know, what they were supposed to hear. And they say that's one of the qualities of the speech of the Buddha. I had this completely freaky experience about 23 years ago. One of my teachers, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, was giving a teaching in San Francisco. And it was sort of organized at the last minute, and only about 21 of us came. And usually when he teaches, it's a huge hall. So we're sitting in someone's living room, and he gave this amazing teaching on the relationship with the teacher. And so I got in touch with the center director after to see if I could get the tapes. That was back in the days of tapes. Remember those? Like with the, you know. And so I'm like, wow, could I get a copy of the tape of that night? It was just amazing. And she goes, yeah, well, we're not distributing it, just the people there. And I was like, no, it's just for my own use. So she mails me, she makes a copy and mails it. Listen to the whole thing. Nothing that I heard was on the tape. And I called her and I'm like, you must have gotten the wrong night. It was just like last Tuesday with all the stuff. And she's like, no. Do-do-do-do. Like, I don't know what that was, but the tape recorder and me have really different karma. Because honestly, this whole huge thing that I heard, I was taking notes.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I listened to the tape all the way through twice, and I was like, okay, wow, that's that thing, I guess. Right? That quality, right, of that omniscience. So, just warning you, be prepared. And it does happen that you hear exactly what you needed to hear, right? So that omniscient mind. And then the Buddha also has to have ways to communicate with us, right? Not just this omniscient mind. So we say that there's two form bodies. One is called the Sambhogakaya, which is usually translated as complete enjoyment body. And that's this sort of purified energy body that it's said that that's the way a Buddha appears in their own Buddha paradise. And we've got a lot of examples of them in the room. Some of these tankas, for example, that you see are depictions of the Sambhogakaya, of the complete enjoyment body. Like there's White Tara, the second one to the, or third one to the right there. White Tara, for example, Medicine Buddha, this blue Medicine Buddha. Some of these depictions, like many of them are Lord Buddha it, you know, holding the begging bowl, but some of these tantric deities are actually the Sambhogakaya form. At high levels of realization, they say that people can get teachings directly from this form of being, and then they drew a picture of it and told us what these beings look like. So a lot of these kind of there's green tar in the back above the snack table. There are these wonderful female Buddhas as well, and those are depictions of this kind of purified sort of astral body, light body, and then the emanation body for the rest of us that aren't at high level of realization and don't have direct conversations with Tara yet. We're still working on it. We say that the Buddhas emanate in a variety of forms to guide us, right? And one of my teachers, Dzogchen Khyentse Rinpoche, he was talking about the different emanation bodies, and this is like so cool. So he said, one of them is called a rebirth emanation. And so that would be somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, like a Buddha gets born into a human body, takes that form for their whole life, enacts the Buddha's, you know, many of us from the Tibetan tradition view His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a Buddha who is emanated in that form as, you know, this Tibetan monk. And then there's another kind of emanation body that's sometimes called an artisan emanation. And that means that a Buddha can manifest even as inanimate objects or whatever would be of benefit. And Master Shantideva says they can show up even as a dog or a bridge, it said in his text, the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. But my favorite one is what's called the blessed emanation. And it's kind of like channeling, right? You can get the Buddha's words through an ordinary being if you have enough virtue. And the Buddha needs to communicate with you. And if your Buddha, if your virtue and the Buddha's power meet, you can even get the Buddha's words through an ordinary being that has no idea that that's what's happening. And my teacher, Dzogchen Khyentse Rinpoche, uses this great example of a waitress in a cafe in Marrakesh. And he says, so the waitress gives you a cup of coffee and says one sentence to you, which is the sentence that just blows your mind and gets you to the next level of the path. So there are a couple of possibilities. She could have been reborn that whole lifetime just to say that one sentence to you. And he says, that's a Buddha's compassion, to go through an entire lifetime just to guide one being one time. Or it could be the channeling thing, that the Buddha blessed her to say that sentence to you, whereas she had no idea that she was acting as kind of a channel for the Buddha's blessing. The Heart Sutra, which some of you are familiar with, most of the dialogue is a blessed emanation. In the very beginning of the Heart Sutra, it says, Buddha blessed Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra to have this conversation. And that the word that's translated as blessed means that kind of an emanation. So basically, Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra are puppets of the Buddha giving this teaching, you know. And then in the end, it says, the other hint says, you know, everybody rejoiced at the words of the Buddha. But the Buddha didn't say anything during the whole time except through the blessed emanation of these two people. So it's very cool, and I love that one, because it sort of reminds me of a practice that I love to do, which I call pronoia, which is just assuming that anything that anybody says to you might be the words of the Buddha being channeled through that person, right? So kind of paying attention to everything that happens as a lesson. You know, whether it is or not, whether it's really the blessed emanation thing or not, who cares? You'll get the lesson if you take it that way. So going around just imagining that everybody is conspiring to get you enlightened. Kind of going through pronoia instead of paranoia, which is everybody's trying to get you. Pronoia is everybody's conspiring to get you enlightened. Right? So it's, and especially the annoying coworkers, right? Because they're trying, it's not just the people that are saying nice things to you. You know, so if you go around with that kind of an attitude, and all of you are here, and you've stuck with me for 5 weeks, what are the chances you haven't had any kind of an experience with a Buddha emanation yet? I'd say pretty slim to non-existent, right? If a Buddhist job description is to emanate, to help you, you know, of the people in this room that are as interested in Buddhism as you are and putting as much effort as you are, what are the chances that you haven't had a Buddha emanation? So practice what a friend of mine calls spiritual revisionism. Go back in your life and think about some of those special people. Maybe when you were in high school and that favorite uncle gave you Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and it got you interested in meditation or something, right? Like going back in your life and thinking, oh, there may have been these Buddha emanations showing up all the time, right? So that blessed emanation or rebirth emanation, who knows what kind it was. So isn't that cool? That's pretty cool. All right. Questions about how Buddhas show up for us? Yeah, Heather.
I was just thinking that maybe it's that channeling thing happened when I say things, and I'm like, why did I say that? From, and then I think about it later, and maybe it was something for the
oh, that happens, you know, as a Dharma teacher, that happens to me all the time.
Yes.
Like, I try and set my motivation before I teach of just, Tenzin Choki doesn't have a clue, basically, but let me channel. And then sometimes the student will ask a question, and usually when my response is, I have no idea what on earth to say, my mouth will just open, and something will come out, and that's always the thing that later on the person goes, oh my God, that thing you said was like perfect. And I'm like, that was not me. I have no idea what that was. So yeah. And how often does it help people? Like you just end up saying something and then sometimes you'll even hear from them. Like, wow, that was amazing. That happened to me one time. I remember this nun. Oh, it was so funny. This nun that I knew, and she came up. And it's almost like she was being used as a ventriloquist dummy or something. Like, I was really struggling with something, and she just came up in this very uncharacteristic way, like looked at me with this incredible focus and said something that really helped. And then she sort of like came to and she goes, I have no idea why I said that. And I was like, I do. Thank you. So yeah, it's weird. I think it's happening. You know, and so thinking back at those times, either that we've received something like that or kind of given it to someone else. So it's interesting. Yeah, Brent.
I love that and like having this kind of spelled out like that because for me, if I ever do that, then like in the moment it can feel really free and then later I'm like that. Like a little pride can kind of come in and it can be like, oh yeah, that's smart. You know, or something. just a little vacation around it. And then it's just like, I'm thinking of like the word grace, which you don't really hear, but it has that sense of like, just this like sacred flowing and
yeah.
And there's no need to hold on to that or kind of claim it or anything
like that.
So it's kind of helpful for someone that struggles for me with pride too.
And I find if I really set my motivation like that, like before I teach, there are a lot of teachings about like waking up first thing in the morning and setting your motivation like, may whatever I do today be of benefit to others. And I always add, like, let me just get out of the way. Like, let my ego and my know-it-allness and my pride and all that stuff just get out of the way so I'm able to just be kind of transmit some of the stuff, you know, from these beings that I have a connection with. I mean, it all sounds very woo-woo, but I think it's like very, you know, just even setting up that intention makes it flow a lot better because then your ego isn't in the way. Because, yeah, otherwise, like somebody's like, oh, my God, that thing you said was so amazing. You'd be like, yeah, I'm amazing. You know? And then it's sort of like, oh, then you're going to just ruin it. But if you just kind of let it flow. And is it external? Is it internal? Is it our own inner wisdom waking up? I mean, that's the thing too. It's not the Buddha's outside channel. It's like, it's not even like that. It's like our own wisdom that's inseparable from the Buddha's wisdom. Like when you think of that Buddha nature, there's no separation between that and the omniscient mind of the Buddha, and it's all just kind of waking up and flowing better. And how cool is that? You know, so I think we even have a false duality of like, oh, it's the Buddha's out there, and I'm just a worthless nobody, but it's like your own inner wisdom kind of, you know. I was thinking of it too as like, almost like our practice makes us like a radio receiver, like the airwaves are full of like Buddha energy, mm-hmm. and we just need to make ourselves like a, you know, tune the dial in to pick up on that energy that's there anyway. Just like you need a radio to hear, you can't just hear with your ears. You know, you need the receiver. So it's almost like Buddhist practice tunes us in and makes us that kind of a receiver for the energy that's just kind of all around. It's so cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that can even happen with a bumper sticker. Yes. I'm serious. I had an experience of being very, very angry at my brother over his lack of being present to my mother's dying. Mm-hmm. And I went for a walk in the park and just feeling the hurt of all of that. And I came across mm-hmm. a bumper sticker on a sort of crummy old car that addressed, and I can't remember exactly what it said, but basically it said, meeting anger with anger makes the whole world go blind. I can't remember the first part of it, but But I just felt as though the universe, was smiling with the wisdom of that, mm-hmm. just a gentle reminder that your response to him is not moving things forward. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's cool. You never know where it's going to come from.
That's one of those artisan emanations. Buddha just manifested his bumper sticker. Never heard so long. Just as he walked by and then it disappeared.
But I was ready for it. Yeah. And it just made me smile. I thought,
That's awesome. I love that. So tuning into that, I mean, I just find that such a joyful practice. It's just being suspicious and pro-noise all the time of just kind of like, what's going to wake me up today? What kind of Buddha emanations are going to show up for me today? And just kind of keeping your antennas out for that can be a lot of fun. And then you really will get a lot of messages because they're kind of all over the place. I think sometimes, I mean, it's just so funny. One of my teachers, Kirti Sanchev Rinpoche, and I get this question sometimes from students too, of like, well, wait, if the Buddhas are emanating like that, and it's their job description to get us enlightened, like, how come the whole world is not just filled with Buddhas? Like, how come I'm not running into the Dalai Lama, like, all the time? And I'm like, A, who knows that you're not? You know, and that you're just going around with blinders on and your own conceptions. And B, you know, we need to be ready and open. And sometimes I think we are walking around with blinders on, and there's enlightened beings surrounding us all the time, like, hey, yo, hey, over here, pay attention. We're like, just not seeing it.
Wait a minute.
So, like, who knows, you know, because it is their job description. So, like I said before, like, what are the chances that we're not running into them and just aren't tuned in to, like, that's what it is that's happening when we hear that wisdom or see the bumper sticker or all kinds of things. I mean, it's just happening all the time. So part of what I find such a joyful practice is trying to tune into that idea and really open to it and kind of go through the world with that kind of a stance of being really receptive, and then watch the fireworks, you know, and watch your path speed up if you can really kind of manage to do that. It's very, very cool. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
This also just feels totally like the complete antidote to kind of paralyzing anxiety and fear and doubt. You know, and that thing, like, there's the magic when we witness someone who kind of really goes against all odds and does something so courageous. You know, like it has this little bit of this energy of getting out of the way and just having that intention. You know,
And I think, like, all we need to do, because we can get so focused on the negative and people that are doing the things that, you know, we're struggling against, and it just seems kind of like endless. You know, and then there's Malala, who gets shot in the face, and like it just makes her stronger. You know, there's so many people, and just the ordinary ones around us all the time. I mean, not just the Malalas and the Desmond Tutus and the Nelson Mandelas, but like the grandmother down the street that has all of her grandchildren because the parents are in jail or something. You know, all of the beings that are just going so above and beyond, like all around us all the time. You know, so it's not even just like these great examples, which is wonderful to think of, but like all of the people just doing courageous, selfless things around us, like all the time. You know, so that's, you know, and it does take a little effort to tune into that and not to be so sucked in with to the anxiety and just the chaos of what's going on. Yeah. All right. So we're going to talk about how to get there after a break. So let's have our break. then I'll tell you how. So any other questions about all the cool stuff we talked about? All the cool inspiring stuff about how Buddhas just show up right and left. So in terms of talking about the path, what I thought I'd do in the time that we've got for the path, like I said, studying the path, if you're interested in Buddhism, can be the rest of your life and subsequent lifetimes too. But just to give a little bit of an outline or an introduction out of all the different ways that I could do it, what I thought to do is introduce you to what we call the three principles of the path, which are three of the main realizations that we work on generating. And then if we have time after we talk about these three, we'll talk a little bit about the six perfections, which is the main path of the bodhisattva kind of track. So let's look at the three principles of the path first. And as some of you who've heard me teach this last couple of weeks know, I kind of have some pet peeves when it comes to translations, like suffering. Renunciation is another one I hate. Whenever I hate a translation, I put it in quotation marks so we can kind of unpack it and come up with alternative translations. And so the three principles of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. So renunciation, terrible, terrible translation. The Tibetan word is nejung, which literally translates as definite emergence. And the definition of this is the determination to become free of samsara. Okay, so that's the first main realization that we're working on generating. A strong determination to become free of samsara, or definite emergence is the literal translation of the Tibetan. And the reason I hate renunciation, when I say renunciation, what does that make you think of?
Giving up things.
And what kind of things?
Like.
Yeah, all the good stuff. Giving up the sex and the chocolate and the warm beds and the fun. And that's not what it is at all. What we're doing when we're renouncing all the causes of suffering. That sounds like a really good idea, right? We're establishing that determination to be free of samsara. One of my friends who teaches, he says, yeah, renunciation, he goes, it sort of makes you think of like nuns in cold convents in the Middle Ages, eating bread and water and wearing a hair shirt. Or that like the whole like Protestant work ethic thing of like being virtuous is being miserable and you need to kind of be miserable and joy is seen as really suspect, right? I think a lot of us are sort of survivors of the Protestant work ethic, which is still very strongly kind of takes a hold. So it doesn't mean anything like that at all. It's just because of understanding the Four Noble Truths thing, right, and understanding that flow chart and where our suffering is caused, and understanding that wherever we're reborn, no matter what realm of existence we're reborn, we're going to be subject to all of those sufferings that we talked about in class one. Remember the list of six, the list of three, all those lists of suffering. We're subject to all of those, no matter where we're born. No matter, even in the best realm of existence, characterized by the greatest sensory pleasures, it will end. And the next place will probably be worse because we've just wasted all of our good karma on sensory pleasures, right? So by really deeply understanding that, we generate a strong wish and determination to just get off the wheel altogether, to just be free of samsara. And that's what renunciation refers to. We're stuck with it, unfortunately, as a translation of that word, and that's why I put it up there. You know, but definite emergence sounds a lot more hopeful and positive than renunciation, because the only thing that we're renouncing is all of the causes of suffering. That's all. You know, that's what we're giving up. So the strong determination to become free of samsara, and we say that that's the first real kind of strong realization that we have on the path, the first kind of big milestone or turning point. And it says, after you have that, you know, in some of the descriptions of renunciation, they say you're not attracted even for a second to the pleasures of samsara, right? You're just like, who cares? They say it's like, there's this sort of earthy metaphor. They say it's like someone who's had hepatitis being presented with a really rich meal. You're just like, ugh, right? Like, even the pleasures of samsara, you're just like, oh, why would I want that? You know, there's so much greater pleasure to be had. So you're not kind of sucked in to those pleasures of samsara because of that determination to be free. And then the second aspect of the path is bodhicitta. So a Sanskrit vocabulary word that literally translates, well, the translation of the word itself, bodhi comes from the same root as Buddha and literally means awakening. And then citta, I put heart, mind, because sometimes in most sort of Eastern cultures and their ways of thought, the seat of consciousness is at the heart, like at the heart. So sometimes if they say mind, they'll point here. We're kind of brainwashed, literally, in, you know, kind of modern thinking to think that our mind is up here, but mind or heart. But the translation of that word bodhicitta is the wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So it's that wish for enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Sometimes you'll hear bodhicitta being used as almost a synonym for compassion or kindness. It's much more than that. It's dependent on compassion and kindness. But the wish to become a Buddha, to benefit all living beings, it's this incredibly fierce determination, right? It's this courageous intention to attain full enlightenment. Just saying, it's the hardest thing for any human being to attain. It takes a lot of work in order to benefit all sentient beings. So thinking of that qualities of a Buddha, as we saw before, we can benefit people, and we do, and we must, given the qualities that we have right now. But when you really think about the qualities of a Buddha and their ability to benefit beings at such a more extensive level than that we're capable of, when you really, really care about beings, then this determination, this strong wish grows, oh, if only I could be a Buddha, then I could really help. You know, and I think a lot of us have felt, you know, a kind of a bittersweet frustration. Like sometimes I felt when my compassion really outstrips any wisdom or ability that I have. Like somebody that you really care about is going through a hard time, and you're just like, I have no clue how to help them. Right? And I see most people nodding. We've all been in that situation of like, I have no idea what to do. You just feel like you have no wisdom, you have no ability, right? So I think it's that kind of bittersweet frustration, for me, has really motivated me a lot on the path. You know, when I felt like, I really care, and I just have no idea what to do to really help, right? So it's kind of coming from that determination to complete the path so that you will have the ability to help. So they say for bodhicitta, the main cause is the wish to benefit beings, and then the means to that end is Buddhahood. So we've got these kind of two aspects to it. The wish to benefit beings by becoming a Buddha. But the main kind of cause is that wish to be a benefit to beings, and then the means to do it. So it's not just wanting to be a Buddha by itself, because, like, wouldn't it be cool to be a Buddha? I mean, look at them. They're just, like, gorgeous and awesome, and, you know, never age, perpetually. Yeah, I would say in the descriptions of the tantric deities, they're perpetually 16. 16 was not my best age. I don't know. In my mind, I think maybe 27 was better. Like, I'm like, no, 16 was not my peak age at all. But anyway, you get the point, right? So it's not just like, oh, wouldn't it be awesome and cool to be a Buddha, just for the sake of that. Or, and it's not just about wishing to benefit beings either, because we have that, and we all do what we do: feed the homeless, try and help in whatever ways we can. But really understanding, to help beings ultimately, to help free beings from suffering forever, we need that wisdom and ability of the Buddha. You know, so if I really care. You know, I feed someone, they're just going to be hungry tomorrow. I help them, and we must do all of that stuff too. And also really see that only by developing to the fullest of our own potential will we have the ability to really help others. And then we won't have that frustration that we always have of, like, I don't have a clue what to do, what to do, and I really care about people and I don't know what to do. So that's bodhicitta. So you can see it's not, I mean, it drives me nuts. Sometimes in these Dharma centers, somebody will make a cup of tea for like four people and people will be like, oh, they're such a bodhisattva. And I'm like, no, they're just nice. They're not, come on. That's not what being a bodhisattva is, In a bodhisattva, another vocabulary word, bodhisattva means something like being, is someone with bodhicitta, right? So we call them a bodhisattva. So sometimes we talk about the bodhisattva path. You know, bodhisattva, one of the translations of bodhisattva that I really, really like, because sattva has a couple of connotations. It means a being, or it means someone with a mind. It also has this connotation of courageous. And so Chökyam Trungpa Rinpoche translates bodhisattva as awakening warrior, and I love that, right? So it's someone, and they're often, like, the word bodhisattva is often coupled with the adjective brave or courageous in the text, because you can see, like, quite apart from being like wimpy niceness, it's like the bravest thing that you can do, right? And it's just this courageous sort of commitment to, you know, attaining this state for the benefit of all being. Lama Zopa, when he's talking about these two components of bodhicitta, the wish for enlightenment for the sake of all beings, he gets this metaphor that I really like, and he says, it's like if you're going, you know, to get lunch, and you pick up a plate to serve the food, and then you sit down and you eat the food off of the plate. He goes, if you just took the plate and you sat down at the table with a bare plate, like, that would be stupid. That would be like becoming a Buddha without benefiting beings. He goes, the only reason for the plate is to serve the food. And the only reason for becoming a Buddha is to be able to benefit beings. So I kind of like that metaphor. Like, you don't get the plate for nothing. You only get it to serve your food, and you only become enlightened in order to benefit beings. So, luckily, because that's seen as such a high level of realization, there's methods for generating bodhicitta, and we're going to talk about that for most of the rest of the time tonight. There's methods for generating it. It's not like you're either born the Dalai Lama or Mother Teresa, or you're hopeless. Like, there are meditation techniques that you can use for sort of awakening that bodhicitta motivation. But any questions so far about those two, either renunciation or bodhicitta, just in terms of kind of the definitions or the qualities?
renunciation is so tricky because I guess that lousy translation, but
yeah.
It's not like, or this is a question, but I'm saying it as a statement.
Yeah.
It's not like you have a choice between, in this perfectly prepared, wonderful meal, and, I don't know, an undercooked Boca burger. So, and you say, oh, well, I'll take the Boca burger because I'm renouncing this. It's not that. You
not
take this
all.
Because it's
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
You enjoy it, and
yeah,
you know,
your karma serves you up a nice meal.
Right,
great, enjoy
there
it.
There we go.
Without
yeah.
attachment.
There
see, that's
go.
The
yeah.
thing.
And it's the karma
it.
Served it up. To, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah, you don't need to deny yourself pleasure. That's some weird, twisted, like I don't know what that is, masochistic.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
The trick.
Or you don't get down on yourself because.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think of like when we were talking about attachment. A couple of weeks ago now saying, look at the way the Dalai Lama enjoys everything. Like Lama Yeshe just got off on everything. Like he just loved everything. Like enjoyment isn't the problem. Attachment is the problem, right? So if we can enjoy things, why not? It doesn't mean we need to eat bread and water and have the hair shirt and live in a cold convent, like by any means. It's just having a realistic idea of the objects of attachment and just kind of having a balanced attitude towards them, and then we can enjoy things with that sort of Teflon rather than Velcro attitude. Like, because the problem is the attachment, the clinging, and the misperceiving that those things are the cause of happiness. Right? Misperceiving that that object caused my happiness. That object was a condition. That meal tasted delicious because I had some virtue and a good karmic seed. The good meal was the condition for that karmic seed to rise. Why is that the case? Because even the nice meal doesn't always taste good. If my heart's just been broken, I don't even taste it. It doesn't taste good at all, right? It's a condition, but we mistake the how for the why. How I felt good was the meal. Why I felt good was my karma. And we do that all the time. Right? So if we have, that's the wisdom we apply to the objects of enjoyment, going, oh, it was really my good karma that served me up this, you know, enjoyable experience. And if my karma is good enough, when I'm a Buddha, everything is going to cause me inconceivable bliss. Which might be what's happening with the Dalai Lama, because he's going around all the time like, wow, you know, like, I don't know what's going on, but wow, it seems pretty good from this perspective of like, what is that, right? So with that wisdom, understanding that, we don't need to deny ourselves things, we just have to have the wisdom of understanding that the objects of enjoyment are not the cause of our enjoyment, it's our karma. That's just a condition, right? That with that condition, if I've got the karmic seed, I'm going to enjoy
yeah.
something.
Okay.
So, if we want to enjoy the heck out of everything, do more virtuous things and get more good karma. And then you'll be enjoying everything all the time. So, it's not the enjoyment that's the problem. Which is why I hate that word, because
mm-hmm.
it makes us
mm-hmm.
think that, doesn't it? Oh, I have to choose the raw Boca burger, which is like so hideous. Over the nice, like, masala dosas that are in my mind today. So we were talking about Carol before, thinking about South Indian food ever since. So, yeah, it's not that. You know, it's not that. However, having said that, there are some objects that we almost always are stupid about. We might, in the short term, want to keep a respectful distance from some of the objects of enjoyment that almost always we lose perspective with. You know, that too, right? Certain
mm-hmm.
things that we just know, you know, are just too Velcro, and we can't be Teflon about them. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no problem at all. It's not like we have to choose to suffer somehow. That's just some weird, twisted
kind of wrong view.
Yeah, thanks for the comment.
Yeah, good.
Something that's been coming up for me for like the past year, and it feels new, but maybe it's not, is I've been having a lot of like food cravings, like sugar or like coffee, and it really feels as like it's. Sounds really silly, but it feels like if I don't have like a piece of candy right now, I'm gonna die. Like it feels like that intense, right? Or like at least like I can't function, like I can't move forward until that need is met. And so like I've tried to come at it like very functionally of like I'll just like not do sugar for 21 days or give up caffeine. But so how in the moment when that's coming up really strong, do I purify that?
Yeah.
And I know it's not gonna necessarily fix the problem in the moment, but like how do I start purifying that? Because that's new.
Interesting.
So I've just been noticing. I was like, where is this coming from? Like,
And sometimes what I find is going in and doing it and then really paying attention. Mm-hmm. How long does the pleasure even last? Like you put, you know, the chocolate cake. After the first bite, you're distracted thinking of something else. You aren't even tasting it anymore. Like some, you know, because sometimes when we deny ourselves something, then it grows even stronger because then we're all so wound up in it. It might be interesting to just pay attention to what happens if you allow yourself to have the thing you're craving and then just watch the experience really mindfully throughout and go, like, how long does the pleasure even last? How much of the pleasure, because I find this to be true so much of the time, so much of the pleasure is actually in the anticipation. Mm-hmm. And then the candy's in your mouth and you're like, God, it's kind of too sweet and it doesn't even taste good. But the grasping comes in the anticipation of the thing. And so sometimes really watching the whole thing, like very mindfully throughout the experience, can kind of cut that craving, because then the next time the craving comes up, you'll be like, it didn't last that long, it didn't taste that good, like what's coming on? Another thing that sometimes I notice is we get these cravings as a distraction from something deeper that we don't want to look at right now. You know, and so it's kind of like I notice certain, you know, obsessive little distraction things come up and I have this obsessive need to do something. If there's something kind of painful that's hard for me to be with right now. So sometimes just knowing that and then being compassionate to yourself. Maybe you're not ready to look at it. Maybe you need more support around that. But if that kind of lands a little bit of like it might be something like that, not beating yourself up for that, but getting whatever support you need to be able to go into whatever it is that's painful. Because I notice that a lot is just my mind is like, you know, just all over the place with distraction because it's like some discomfort that I don't want to face, you know, so it's often that too. And just physiologically, we don't get enough rest ever. And we keep ourselves amped on caffeine and sugar. So a lot of that addiction is just because we don't get enough rest. I mean, that's the non-Buddhist, like, just physiology reason. So and it may be a combination of some of those things too. Yeah. All right. Where were we? Bodhicitta. Yeah. So Bodhisattva, being who's generated that realization. Sometimes we talk about aspiring and engaging Bodhicitta. So aspiring Bodhicitta is really just the wish for enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Engaging Bodhicitta is we're engaging in the practices that will make it happen. And the metaphor often given in the text is it's the difference between like planning a trip, you know, sitting down with your Lonely Planet and like going online and checking out the ticket prices and then actually buying your ticket and going, right? So it's kind of between thinking about it and actually embarking on the journey. Sometimes I think there's another level that's not really talked about in the text, and it's wishing to have the wish for enlightenment for the sake of all beings. It's sort of the admiration. Like, we don't really have it. Like, I remember when I first heard about this, I was like, wow, that would be so cool to have that noble wish. But whoa, I'm not anywhere near. So it's almost like pre-wishing, pre-aspiring bodhicitta. I think that's another thing, which is already cool, because at least you are like, that would be amazing to have that, you know. So bodhicitta, I think that's like a starting point, is just wanting to develop that wish. And then correct view, seeing the ultimate nature of reality. We're going to talk about that in a lot more detail next week. That's going to be like the, you know, maraschino cherry on top of the dessert. It's going to be the ultimate nature of reality. So what I wanted to do in the time that we've just got a little time left, I want to just introduce you to the methods for generating bodhicitta, just so that we'll at least be introduced to that language. And then actually going through the practices is kind of a longer story, but at least so you know. And they say that there's two lineages of instruction for developing bodhicitta. One is called the seven-point cause and effect method, and one is called the equalizing and exchanging self and others method. And this is the one that we're going to be looking at tonight in a little bit of detail. The seven-point cause and effect method is also incredibly powerful. The first step is realizing that all beings have been your mother in some lifetime. And as Holiness the Dalai Lama says, and in the traditional text they say, that's actually a really hard realization to get. So as Holiness says often, for modern people, he says, I think the equalizing and exchanging self and others method is more appropriate because it doesn't depend on this whole thing of all beings have been your mother, so you already have to buy into rebirth and the different realms of existence, and then every mosquito has been your mother at some point. I mean, that's a lot. You know, so equalizing and exchanging self and others doesn't depend on all of that, you know, kind of thinking that for some people is starting with just a high kind of hurdle to get over of like, you know, oh, all beings, you know, which is just because I've been reborn countless times and there's countless beings, so in some rebirth, every being is there, you know, it's just a lot to kind of take on board. So we're going to look at the equalizing and exchanging self and others and just put that briefly and then look at it a little bit more next time. So the prerequisite, actually, to both lineages is equanimity meditation. And I know a lot of you have done this kind of meditation. It's overcoming our strong partiality. And so one of the ways that we do equanimity meditation is imagine a friend, an enemy, and a stranger seated in front of us, and then really examine our different attitudes towards these three people. You know, hopefully coming to a conclusion that they're all the same as human beings, wanting to be free from suffering, wanting happiness. So the equanimity, kind of the conclusion of that meditation, is try to, whether we like people or not, wish them all to have happiness and freedom from suffering. So it doesn't mean everybody's our best friend. It also doesn't mean you're not allowed to have friends. It just means whether you like someone or not, you wish everyone equally to have happiness and freedom from suffering. So that's kind of leveling the playing field before we can even begin, right, trying to develop bodhicitta. At least we need to try and overcome our strong partiality in terms of people. And the traditional texts say that can take months, even years, to really develop equanimity. So it says here prerequisite, but it's already quite a job, you know, and quite a big realization. And then equalizing self and others, and this is just the main point here, is just we're all the same in wanting happiness and wanting to be free from suffering. It doesn't mean we're the same as all other beings. It doesn't mean we're all one big shared mind stream. It just means we're equal in terms of our wish for happiness and wish to be free from suffering. And then we look at the disadvantages of self-cherishing. And by self-cherishing, we mean that total self-absorbed, it's all about me, I've got to have everything go my way, you know, my way or the highway kind of attitude. It's not just self-care, it's not self-compassion, it's not a reasonable way of taking care of ourselves. So what are some of the disadvantages when we have that exaggerated self-absorption?
It's stressful. It's really stressful.
Yeah, in what way is it stressful?
Because everything has to go my way, otherwise, you know, like nothing's right, and
yeah,
other people are in my way, and
yeah, yeah. It doesn't even give us happiness at all, does it? It's just, you know, as a recovering control freak, you know, I know what that feels like. I actually think now I'm more of a control enthusiast. I've really made a lot of progress, but you know, we have to eat Thai food tonight. No, we can't eat Chinese. It's got to be, you know, it's so stressful, and just so your mind just gets so tight and kind of narrow. And then what about your relationships with others when you have, they just flourish, don't they? What about all your friends that really want Chinese for a really long time? Right? So, yeah, it, you know, the way it makes us feel, the way it makes our relationships, like no advantages at all. And then we also see in the long term, most of our actions, maybe all, of our negative actions that create negative karma are done with a motivation of self-cherishing. I mean, you can really look, think of the 10 non-virtues. Which one of those is not done, you know, from a motivation of self-cherishing? So it doesn't feel good in the moment because our mind gets so anxious and tight. It doesn't make a harmonious atmosphere for us with the people around us. And then it buys us a bunch of bad karma for future suffering. So it's a really bad idea, you know, this whole thing. And it's funny, this self-cherishing, you know, it's really promoted by trillions of dollars worth of advertising industry who's trying to sell us on this idea that we need all this stuff for ourselves. And my father's mantra when I was growing up, I remember my father used to tell me, honey, look out for number one, because nobody else is going to look out for you. I mean, terrible. That was his advice to me, was like to be self-cherishing, basically, which didn't give me happiness, really didn't give him much happiness. So in our culture, it really is kind of hammered into us, but there's a lot of energy trying to sell us on this idea of, you know, self-cherishing is the way to happiness. So I say, just resist. It's not true. It doesn't work. And then cherishing others, and this is just this kind of feeling of, you know, looking out for others, wishing for them to have happiness, thinking of what's best for everybody in any given situation. What are some of the advantages of that kind of an attitude? Yeah.
It's like having freedom for myself.
Yeah.
Expansion of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of the opposite of what Heather was saying, that tight, locked in.
Yeah.
It's just this freedom, like you don't have to worry about yourself at all. It's like there's this wonderful spaciousness there, you know. Like what happens to your relationships when you're looking out for the benefit of everybody around you? You know, everybody will want to hang out with you. You want to be popular? Just be generous and kind to others, you know, that thing. And also we say, so kind of the same 3 points, and then in the long term, in terms of like our positive karma and our virtue, most of it is done with the motivation of cherishing others too, all of the good things that we do and the virtuous things that we do. So when you just look at, oh, what's going to give me the most happiness, even in the short term, it's so clear, isn't it? You know, really working on it. So this whole idea that kind of overcoming self-cherishing and cherishing others is going to make you kind of a miserable martyr, it's just so not true. And we can even feel like the energetic shift when you think about one and the other, just the kind of palpable feeling in that feeling in your mind. And then the fourth step of this method is the actual exchange. And what that means is, in those moments when you could be getting something just for yourself, or you could be thinking about benefiting others or what everybody in the situation would like, then you make that actual exchange. You know, you're starting to really think more from a perspective of thinking about the greater good for everybody in the situation and not just what you can get out of it. Right? And then the last step, the main meditation for this technique is called giving and taking, Tonglen. And I thought to do that on, I know that some of you have done, actually just recently, a whole, a several week class in Tonglen meditation. And I thought to do that for the Sunday morning class, explain in some detail Tonglen and doing the practice. And it's this beautiful meditation practice where you can actually practice loving kindness and compassion in the same meditation session. And so it's the main kind of method for this equalizing, exchanging self and others kind of method for generating bodhicitta. So I'll kind of hold off on the explanation of Tonglen practice for Sunday morning if anybody can come then, and then we'll explain it a little bit more next time. Any questions about these five steps? Yeah, Brent.
not to get totally political in this, but I keep thinking lately, like, these terms that for me I'm coming to know about, like, kind of entitlement and, I mean, and I hope this isn't offensive to anyone, like, you know, these conversations about, like, white privilege and toxic masculinity and all these things, and, like, what we're seeing in our culture right now, it just kind of feels like it's, like, reaching this crux of following that individualist, like, look out for number one. We've been following that now for hundreds of years, and it's like,
yeah,
it's just all ramping up and speeding up, and it just feels to me like that confusion of when I focus just on me, it just, like, it sucks, like, everything I want is, like, connection and closeness, and it just sucks that out of it. So even though I might have good stuff right there, it's like I can't even, it's like a hungry ghost existence. I can't feel the goodness there.
Yeah.
And then I'm afraid to switch gears and actually care about someone else. It's like, I don't know. So there's those things, just like, they feel like it's like this pervasive poison that just for me, I just feel like that's what's alive in the world of pain.
Yeah, And just, you know, it's so interesting. I had to write for one of my online courses, and it was actually a prompt from NVC, and it was Marshall Rosenberg's thing of, like, all, now you're going to have to help me out, all suffering comes from unmet needs. Is it that, like, any
judgments?
I think the way it was, the prompt for this class I was doing was, like, any moment of suffering is just comes from an unmet need, something like that. And I was thinking about, like, all of these cases of these people who, you know, are just, to me, acting out of these, the pain that comes from unmet needs and causing so much suffering for others.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can really get down below the armoring and the posturing and all of that and just go, wow, there's so much pain because of the disconnection, you know, and I think it's just, I mean, for me, our, you know, North American culture has gotten so disconnected. Everybody doesn't feel any responsibility for anybody else anymore.
Right.
It's like that sense of isolation and alienation has gone to such a tipping point that it's so easy to just be thinking only of yourself and not see the ramifications. I think, you know, the checks and balances that used to be always there in any kind of connected culture. There's this great book by Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature, and it's like 900 pages or something, but it's so brilliant. He kind of goes through, his premise is we're becoming less violent as a culture, which kind of is contrary to what we think after the last century with the two world wars in it. But anyway, one of the things that he is talking about is just how traditional culture, like, solved things like the free rider problem, like people who didn't contribute to the culture didn't benefit from it. But now we're all so disconnected that we can all just do these crazy things just on our own and just spiral out of control because the normal checks and balances of living in an interconnected way aren't there. So I think it really, and now we're just seeing a lot of the effects of that in terms of just these extreme behaviors of these people in power. It's just, that's really interesting. And it really does boil down to lack of connection.
Yeah.
You know, and lack of kind of
moment of cherishing someone else that allows me to get out of the kind of prison of cherishing myself. Like that almost is kind of what connects that moment of connection is.
So fostering that in whatever ways we can, you know, and just in tiny ways, like really looking for connection with the other, just setting up out of our, you know, things. So,
And the experience of being cherished, a friend of mine defines authentically being charming makes someone else feel better about themselves. Which I think is quite wonderful, really. When somebody really authentically cherishes you, I think it does reflect in yourself. You feel suddenly a little better about who you are.
Nice. That's very sweet. I like that. I really try and always, you know, one of the kind of, we'll look next week when we look at the six perfections, and one of the perfections is giving. And one of them is giving material things, which is the one we would think of. And one is just giving love. And I think of that is just in terms of giving kindness to others and just even smiling at others. And I always try, like in stores, to call people by their name. It's on their name tag. Nobody ever uses it. And you just call someone by name. And all of a sudden you've like seen them as a human being. And even if they're just checking out your groceries, like there's some kind of like thing that happens. It's sort of like giving them that gift of being seen in that moment. And I think, you know, a mini cherishing of them just in that moment. So I think there's so many ways we can do it that we just miss, you know, because we're not tuned into that either. Like, how can we be generous just with our love and kindness throughout the day of other people? And it makes us so much happier too. Anything else prompted by this great list? All right. Well, that's more than enough for tonight. What do you guys think? That was a lot. You know, I'm racing through a little bit just because our time is limited. So next week, what we'll do is, so this Sunday, if you can come, I'll do the Tonglen practice and go into that a little bit more. I know not everybody can make it on Sunday morning, but I know some of you are kind of Sunday morning regulars. And then next week, what I want to do is just talk a little bit more about that correct view or the wisdom, seeing the ultimate nature of reality, go into that. And then if we have time, we'll look at the six perfections. Like I said, I'm just trying to touch on some of the main aspects of the path, even though it's not much and there's so much to be done, but at least to kind of give you a bit of an outline, kind of moving forward, although there's so much to be said. So keep showing up if you're interested in the path. That's what this place is all about. So let's take a minute to dedicate the positive energy. So just thinking of this wonderful discussion that we've had tonight, looking at the goals of the path, looking at Buddhahood, looking at the three principal aspects of the path, and really unpacking some of this material around bodhicitta and generating bodhicitta. So much positive energy that we generated in just these 2 hours that we've been together. So let's dedicate all of that positive energy and just aiming it towards that ultimate altruistic intention of full enlightenment for the benefit of all.